Probing space and time. Probing for the truth. What is this film? What are they? From where or whence do they come? What is their purpose? Why is it happening? Why do they both reveal and lurk in the shadows simultaneously? This is the Probe.
I'm here with Robert Selby, Edward O'Reilly. I'm Mark O'Connor. The show is The Probe. And we have as a special guest on this week's episode, Stanton Friedman, who is the world's, in my opinion, the world's foremost UFO researcher and a person, if you've heard of the place called Roswell and associated with a UFO crash, he is the person responsible for that. And I think the world's foremost expert on that particular event, and he's hot back from the 70th anniversary of the Roswell crash. And Robert said, I had to ask you right off top, Stanton, if there's anything new that came out of the 70th anniversary celebrations that you attended.
Well, one thing that was new was that the attendance was up 70% over last year. There were over 7,000 people in Roswell for the festival weekend. And considering that Roswell's in the middle of nowhere, I mean, it's 200 miles from Albuquerque, 200 miles from El Paso, 200 miles from Amarillo. If you're there, it's because you want to be there. It's not on the way to anywhere. And so it was a great festival. Halls were packed. The streets were packed. I sold all my books.
Well, congratulations.
Well, you know, I've been to a lot of these. I did miss one when I had a heart attack. The doctor says you can't go. Okay, I listened to the doctor.
That's good.
That's always a good thing to listen to the doctor.
Yeah, especially when it's so far away. Three flights to get there for me.
Wow.
Long haul. But, yeah, it went extremely well. And, the tone was great. It's not only loads of people, but serious people and people coming to the museum. Just to give an indication of public interest, the last year, 208,000 people visited the International UFO Museum Research Center in Roswell.
Wow.
It sounds... That's a lot of people for a town of under 50,000 in the middle of nowhere.
It sounds like there might be an upswing in interest in extraterrestrial things. This is Bob, by the way.
Well, I don't think it ever went away. I don't think it's just been a completely rising curve, if you will. Now, there have been some changes that have partly led to that. One of them is that we've found all those planets out there. So where Frank Drake of the SETI movement was saying years ago that there might be 8,000 places in the galaxy that could be sending signals, now, thanks to the Kepler satellite finding planets all over the place, it appears a better number would be 8 to 20 billion planets in our own galaxy, not considering all the other galaxies. So that's certainly changed the perspective.
Yep. Mr. Friedman said, speaking, I do a show and I do a little bit about astronomy and exoplanets. And in fact, now that you brought the subject up, you probably heard of the Earth Similarity Index, in which they started to actually categorize some of these planets, Earth being given a value of 1.0, and then I think Mars is something like 0.8, and then up or down the scale. I was looking at that last night, and even within about 39 light years of Earth, there's something like 8 to 10 fairly good Earth-like or Earth-sized rocky planets that seem to be in the Goldilocks zone, the habitable zone of their stars. So I was wondering, you mentioned about the changes in the attitudes towards the whole subject. You think that may be one of the primary factors?
Well, I think so. But I think, look, I've given over 700 lectures. I gave my first lecture in 1967. That's a long time ago, it seems, but 50 years. I've only had 11 hecklers in over 700 lectures, and I come on very, very strong.
Yeah.
So the acceptance has been there most all of the time. Part of that is there's growing recognition that on occasion governments don't tell us the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that's a big statement to make, but
Watergate might have added to something.
Yeah, this is the cosmic Watergate.
So the, you know, and funny, you mentioned about the changing attitudes, and this is might seem like a bit out of left field, but it was just an interview that Hillary Clinton gave during the campaign. You may have even seen it. She was on the Jimmy Kimmel Show, who tends to take everything kind of lightly. And he asked her that, and I thought, oh boy, here we go. But she gave a very matter-of-fact answer.
Yes.
There was no derision on his part. There was none in the audience.
That's right.
And I was struck by that. And even her opponent, who, you know, we know what he is, didn't seem to make overly, I don't think he mentioned it. And I was
thinking, I don't think he did. I haven't seen any comments.
So is that different? Would 10 years ago have produced a different response, and maybe your attitudes are?
I don't know. But as I say, I can tell you 700 lectures, some with crowds as big as 2,200 people and hundreds of radio and television shows.
Yeah.
And answering, I once figured, 60,000 questions between the shows and the colleges and, you know, the whole business. The attitudes have been much more positive than the nasty, noisy negativists would have us believe.
Yeah.
In other words, the notion that everybody with any brains thinks this is a crazy subject is simply not true. I've been out there, and I come on strong. I'm not an apologist, ufologist. That's a good phrase. Apologist, ufologist.
It's hard to say.
Say it quickly.
Yeah, 10 times fast. No.
I won't try that one.
The very few people now are telling me that we must be the only ones. 50 years ago, a lot of people were saying, ain't nobody else out there, because if they were there, we would know about it, because we're so smart.
Right.
And, you know, to get another number to go in with what you were saying, there, within 100 light years of here, there's approximately 10,000 stars. The latest Kepler data suggests that there's between 1 and 1.6 planets per star. So within a mere 100 light years, we're talking about between 10,000 and 16,000 planets. I'm not saying they all have life.
Right.
They don't need to. That isn't the question. The question isn't are all UFOs alien spacecraft? The question is, are any? And my answer is, yes, indeed.
Well, you know, with the Kepler Space Telescope telling us all this stuff, it's hard to remember that merely 20 years ago that the scientific community, the astronomy community, still speculated that maybe there were no other planets or that they were very rare. So, like you say, it's
we're thousands of light years apart.
Right, and now we're saying within 100 light years of, I forget the figure you used, Stanton, but it's a
between
large...
10,000 and 16,000 planets.
Right. And that number may go up if there's a bias. I think it's to the low side. Personally, I think as Kepler discovers more, that then the revisions will be upward.
Well, and there's another part of the story, too. It's not just how many planets there are, but there are many stars that have other stars very close to them. We're out in the boondocks here in our solar system. Next star over is 4.3 light years.
Yeah.
But there are stars that have neighboring stars well under a light year apart. You know, in the famous Betty and Barney Hill abduction case, there was a star map seen and a lot of work done, as it's described in my book with Kathleen Marden, Captured. But the base stars, based on that map, are only 39.3 light years from here. Can't see them from here. You got to go down below the equator. I just wish at the end of my lecture I could go outside. Come on, I'll show them to you.
You need to lecture in Australia.
Well, I have, as a matter of fact, and in Argentina and stuff.
But, we can't see Proxima Centauri either, unfortunately. But.
Well, the thing is that we have stars, well, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli, the Hills case stars, are an eighth of a light year apart. Each one is visible all day long from the other one. And it seems to me that the closer you have a near neighbor, the more likely you are to develop interstellar travel. We're Johnny-come-latelys.
Yeah.
Nobody around, you know. But let's face it, you'd be more concerned for an eighth of a light year, wouldn't you? You know, more likely to traipse over to see what do those guys have that we can steal? That's what the Earthling attitude would be, I guess. But
we wouldn't be first on the visitation list, I guess.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. And when you figure that there are stars that are, you know, six billion years older than the sun. You know, plenty of time for others. Look how short a time it has been. The first radio signal long distance we received was in 1900. First space flight, 1903. Surely there are others who've been at this very much longer than we have. And it's easy to forget how, in such a short time, we went from, well, Kitty Hawk, and the great astronomer 3 months before that saying that if there was one thing he was certain of, man would never fly any distance in a vehicle, maybe a balloon. That was in 1903, 3 months before the Wright brothers' first flight. In 1956, a great astronomer, British Astronomer Royal, you can't get any higher on the scale than that, said space travel is utter bilge. Who will pay for it? What good would it do? What we need is better instruments for astronomy. And astronomy has benefited the most from the space program. You know, Sputnik went up a year later.
Yeah, we're in the golden age of astronomy right now, I think.
Well, yeah, I think astronomers will catch up. I've done some papers on the past. As a matter of fact, I gave a talk not long ago on astronomy versus ufology. And the astronomers have been pretty slow on the uptake. There are a couple of areas where they really don't know anything. One is government secrecy. Two is interstellar travel. Three is motivation. Now, if you were trying to figure out why somebody did something, you might go to a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a police officer, a lawyer, but an astronomer? They don't deal with people and motivation and stuff like that. And so I've had encounters with astronomers. I've done debates. Dr. Seth Shostak of the SETI Institute, you know, SETI stands for Silly Effort to Investigate. Well, it does. They assume ain't nobody out there. Ain't nobody coming here. There's life all over the place out there, but they're not coming here. They're sending us signals. Why?
Well, they're sending it on WXO Planet FM.
Right. I mean, in other words, they haven't done their homework. And it's important about the secrecy thing because, remember, the Manhattan Project was developed in total secrecy to develop atomic bombs. That wasn't a public project. You know, anybody want to work here? We got plenty of jobs for it. They did have plenty of jobs, but they sure didn't say they had anything to do with developing an atomic bomb. You know, so technology. What's strange here? Astronomers are all well aware that the stars produce their energy by nuclear fusion. Now, that's a new notion. Back in the 1920s, it was thought that it was massive burning gas. That's what a star is. And then Hubble did some very interesting work that suggested it was something more than that. But we didn't discover fusion until 1938.
Yeah.
That's not very long ago. That's after I was born. We didn't even know there were neutrons until 1932.
Right, right.
And, you know, people forget, if they ever knew, what an enormous difference nuclear makes in how much energy you can produce, about going somewhere, how many big bombs you can... Well, let me cite some numbers. In 1944, a big bomb was a 10-ton blockbuster. Boy, it took a big B-29 to carry it, make an awful big hole in the ground, and we dropped lots of them. The next year, 45, the first fission device, atomic bomb, if you will, released the energy of not 10 tons of dynamite, but 16,000 tons of dynamite. In 1952, the first H-bomb, fusion device, released the energy of 10 million tons of TNT. One stinking bomb. Yeah. And I'm a nuclear guy, and I still say I don't like bombs, but what the heck.
They may prove our undoing one of these days.
And incidentally, the Russians set one off. I hate to say this, but 57 million tons. One bomb released that much energy. Now, the reason for mentioning this is not to scare people, but to point out that with that kind of energy, you can talk about going to the stars. You know, if aliens see us, they would say, we don't want those idiots out here.
Well, you know what's most striking to me, Stanton, is you made the point that you don't have to go very far back in our human history. Less than 100 years ago, you didn't have electricity, you didn't have mass phone communication, you didn't have flight. When you think of how far we've come in such a compressed, short period of time, it's hard to imagine another intelligent civilization that might have millions of years, never mind a mere speck. But they could accomplish. So I think there's probably all kinds of things in terms of scientific discoveries, in terms of energy sources and advances in physics and stuff that are still to unfold that humans don't know about today.
Well, I'm certain of that. My rule is that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. Anybody thinks we know it all, we're just going to improve it, is wrong. Just look at our history over the last 140 years or so.
It seems like, astronomers, some of them are the worst offenders that, you know, when they talk about, well, someone mentions the decreased distances between potential Earth-like worlds, and it's not thousands of light years anymore, it's tens of light years.
Yeah.
And they say, well, you know, it would take us, you know, 50,000 years or whatever, and, you know, forgetting the fact that we've barely been to our own moon and back.
Well, in every area, we've had great improvements. Well, look, Magellan. How long does it take to go around the world? Well, 3 years. Magellan proved that, right? Well, you know, the science fiction writer took it down to 80 days.
And right, today, Jules Verne, right.
The space station does it in 95 minutes.
Right.
Yeah. But it is not just a fast ship.
No.
Well, so we've set the groundwork, which is that we could have visitors from other intelligence elsewhere in our galaxy that is hardly just within the realm of science fiction. And we seem to have evidence that it's happening. Roswell, yeah. We would be doing you a great disservice and our audience a disservice if we had you on the show and didn't talk more specifically about Roswell and sort of maybe even give our audience just a little refresher on what Roswell was. And I know Robert is just itching to ask you some more questions about Roswell.
I'm the mundane one.
Briefly, Roswell was an interesting place. I just got back. I spent a week there at the most successful festival they've had. Over 7,000 people in this little town over the weekend. But in 1947, Roswell had a base, the Roswell Army Airfield, later Walker Air Force Base, which was the most It had the most elite military group in the entire world, 509 Bomb Group. Why do I say that? They were the guys who dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and two more in Operation Crossroads in 1946. Everybody had a high-level security clearance. There was nobody in the world outside that group that at that time had atomic bombs. So that made it a target for spies, obviously, wanting to find out what we were doing. You can understand that. It just so happens that something happened, a crash. I'll call it a crash because I don't know what else to call it. In early July, out in the middle of nowhere, 80 miles from Roswell. I mean, they call it the Roswell incident. It was really near the little town of Corona.
Right.
And a tiny town. Roswell wasn't big at that time, 130,000.
So Roswell is in the middle of nowhere, and Corona is
even more nowhere.
Right.
Well, if you drive down there a lot, and I've driven quite a bit in New Mexico, it really is. It's a long distance between places, and very little traffic between, say, Albuquerque and Roswell. It's 200 miles. But there ain't nothing in between, man. So I had a call from an English reporter. I don't understand why I don't just drive your car up to the crash site there and go and park it at the roadside and go with a metal detector and find wreckage. I said, you ever been to New Mexico? No. I said, well, there is no road at the crash site. What do you mean there is no road? Of course there's a road. There's a road everywhere. Not in New Mexico, man. And I happen to have the numbers that how many people England had versus New Mexico. New Mexico is twice as large as England, and England had, I forget, 20 or more times as many people as New Mexico did, more than that. There's nothing there. And she didn't understand that. She really had a problem with that.
So in 47, they had a military base there. Did they also, in addition to having the specialized bombers that dropped Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs and so forth, did they also happen to have special advanced weather stations with weather balloons in Roswell?
Like every other air base, had weather balloons. Of course, they released them every day because when pilots took off, they wanted to know which way the winds are blowing, how much gas they need to carry, you know, stuff like that, what the drag would be.
Isn't one of their explanations, U.S. Air Force's explanations for the crash?
They had four. The first was it was a flying saucer. That's what those papers said, because that's how it was described. This is 2 weeks after Kenneth Arnold, incidentally, described 9. I'm just reading a terrible article focusing on a historian for NASA. I mean, it's kind of crazy.
Kenneth Arnold is the gentleman that coined the term flying saucers, is that right?
Yeah, and he didn't say... He said they flew like a saucer would if you skipped it across the water. But the press interprets it. He didn't say it looked like a flying saucer. But you know how if you skip a stone across the water, it sort of bounces along?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was what he was saying, that these things flew in a pouncy kind of way. And there were 9 of them. This article I'm just looking at said one. He saw one object. Not only did he see 9 objects, but Kenneth Arnold made observations. He didn't just say, I looked out my window and there were 9 objects going by. He actually timed their flight from in front of Mount Adams to in front of Mount Adams.
And that's in Washington State, is that right?
Yeah. In Washington State. And he timed their flight. He knew the distance between the two mountains. They were going more than 1,200 miles an hour, which may not sound so great today, but back then, airplanes didn't go faster than 700 miles an hour. So what the heck was this thing?
Right.
He thought it was a secret government system.
So Kenneth Arnold coined the term flying saucers, which I know is your preferred term for, you prefer it over UFOs.
Yes, because all flying saucers are UFOs. Very few UFOs are flying saucers.
True enough.
You know, all great-grandfathers are men. Not all men are great-grandfathers. I happen to be one, but
that's good to hear.
But, New Mexico was a quiet place out in the middle of nowhere. Remember, again, the important security aspect of Roswell. The only atomic bombers in the world. And so they were concerned, quite naturally, who the heck is checking us out.
So we have a crash on Mac Brazeau's ranch outside Corona in 47. The United States Air Force issued a press release, and it appeared in the papers that there was a flying saucer that crashed. And very quickly, within a day, I think they changed their story into explanation number 2. Is that correct, Stan?
Yes, they did. The story went out in the morning, and later that day, sorry, folks, we made a mistake. Just a radar reflector weather balloon combination. That was explanation number 2. Then there was, it's a Mogul balloon. This was much later. And I'm just reading this article and they talk about it being 600 feet tall. It's a Mogul balloon. That's nonsense. The Mogul balloon was a trail of a train of 25 or so, between 20 and 25. Regular standard weather balloons linked by twine.
When I think about that explanation, I think, what kind of idiot would mistake a balloon material, for a crashed flying saucer? I mean,
nobody,
right?
Would.
Nobody. You'd have, I do have to say that story just doesn't ring a bell for me as being potentially credible.
Look, Jesse Marcel, the base intelligence officer, who the rancher came in with his wreckage. The Colonel Blanchard, the base commander, asked Jesse to take the counterintelligence corps guy out with them, and they followed the rancher out. There was no way to tell anybody where it was. You can't go 3 blocks this way and 4 blocks that way. There's very few roads out there. So they followed the rancher out. They find this large area, many acres, covered with weird wreckage. Jesse had seen crashed airplanes in the Pacific. He was in the war there. And there's standard stuff. You know, there's vacuum tubes, there's radios, there's tags saying made in Oshkosh, all kinds of stuff, you know. There wasn't any of that. And he told me in our first conversation, which wasn't until 1978, that he was sure there had to have been a mid-air explosion. Why? Because A, the stuff was spread out over such a large area, and B, there was no crater. He had seen where airplanes have crashed. There's a big hole in the ground.
This is Bob, Mr. Friedman. Did he describe that foil-like material to you? That's one of the things that fascinates me the most, that it could be crumpled up, and then it would take its original shape.
And you couldn't cut it. You couldn't burn it. He had one of his guys took a match to this.
Actually,
does that fit the material used in the Mogul balloon when they said it's a Mogul balloon? It's like,
of course not.
Right, okay.
I mean, you know, it's one of those things that you have to say, how stupid did they think we are? Well, if you tell a lie often enough, it gets believed.
I guess the fireman's daughter described it too. And of course, she was one of the ones that was threatened. And the way she described it, it was like water. The material, it would just
very light.
Yeah, light, and it would fly. It would be flat again on the table. And so she used the word water. And
she was at the meeting last week in Roswell.
She was she? She was.
Oh yeah, still alive.
She was one of the threatened ones. Another person that I wanted to ask about, I'm right into Roswell, unfortunately, but it really fascinates me, was the nurse that spoke to Glenn Dennis. She was asked to come into the autopsy room with the alien bodies, and she described her experiences, which were horrifying, to Glenn Dennis, and then she disappeared. Was she ever tracked down?
We made an enormous effort, and we never did find her. And I don't know what that means.
Does that mean they let her disappear?
Well, supposedly there was a plane crash in Angel, but we haven't found anything. You know, what can I say? I did find some of the nurses.
Yes.
Because there were young airmen there who were paying attention to nurses.
All right. Yes.
And I tracked one down, talked to her brother. She was in Georgia, or had been. She died. But she had been at the base. And, I have a base yearbook.
Yes.
I mean, I was fortunate. Lucky, would that be a better way of putting it?
Well, both are good.
When I first heard this story, I didn't know what to make of it. And people say, oh, you were looking for a witness. No, I wasn't. I was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to give a lecture at Louisiana State University. Flying saucers are real. Mm-hmm. And I was doing three interviews in a local television station, and did the first two, and the third reporter was nowhere to be found. Station manager is giving me coffee. And out of the blue, he says, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel, brilliant investigator that I am. I said, who's he? His next sentence changed my life. He handled wreckage of one of those saucers you're interested in when he was in the military. What? You know, that came out of the blue. And he was obviously being serious. There wasn't anybody around. He wasn't making a joke. We did find the reporter and finished the rest of the thing. But he says, what do you know about him, I asked. He lives in Houma. That didn't tell me anything. I didn't know where Houma was. I was there later to talk to Jesse. But he's a great guy, rolled ham radio buddies. And I found out later Jesse hadn't told him anything. But he had seen the articles in the newspaper. And I'm looking at some of these terrible articles I see, make it sound as if there was only something in the Roswell paper. It was headlines from Chicago West. And Chicago Daily News, the San Francisco paper, the Sacramento paper, the Spokane paper, all over the place. The wire services picked up stories back then. You know, that's how it worked.
Is there a theory as to where the physical evidence may have been spirited away? For instance,
sure.
The bodies and the parts of the flying saucers? I mean, is there a theory as to where it might still be?
Either? Oh, yes. Well, remember, though, I worked on classified work for the government for 14 years. There are loads of places that can hide stuff where the public doesn't have access. But Area 51 is one obvious place.
Yes.
There are underground bases out west in the United States. You put bases underground because there are spy satellites.
Right.
You don't want anybody to see what you're doing. And, you know, it's important that you keep your work secret. And, you know, people forget. The United States was, overconfident in General Ramey, not General Ramey.
Blanchard?
The man who was in charge of the atomic bomb program, I'll think of his name one of these days.
That wasn't Oppenheimer, was it?
No.
No, he was a general. I can't
General Groves. Leslie Groves. He was asked in 1948 how long it would take before the Russians would have an atomic bomb. And he said, well, you know, they got hurt by the war. They lost 20 million men. It'd probably take at least 8 years. Took one more year. Mm-hmm. So we weren't prepared. We said they didn't have a means for delivering them anyway. Turned out they'd copied one of our B-29s that had been left as part of the Lend-Lease program, and pretty soon they had a fleet of them. And so the United States was scrambling in the late 40s, especially after 49, when we found that the Russians had exploded an atomic bomb. What? You know, it was, you're kidding me. No, we're not kidding you, General. There were a lot of political ramifications of all this stuff. We couldn't get caught with our pants down, you know. And I heard a program in which some Russian generals had said that Stalin intended to attack us in the early 50s. Now, this guy on the air, was a Russian, claimed that actually Stalin was assassinated by some generals because they didn't want a war. They lost 20 million people in the war, you know. But what I'm saying is the world was a dangerous place. The Cold War was real, but there were bombs and, you know, airplanes all behind that. Call it cold is one thing, but the reality is there was a lot of stuff going on.
Mr. Friedman, I was just going to mention something. You mentioned about the cosmic Watergate and the cover-up that's been, well, I guess, how 70 years now from Roswell alone. I saw an interview, or I guess I read it, and I don't know how much credibility there is. It's kind of half humorous and half not, but apparently there was one UFO investigator who said he got a hold of someone in the know and asked this person, well, why the cover-up? Why didn't you just trust people to tell them the truth about all this? And apparently, and this might be apocryphal, but it might be true, The government official looked back at him with kind of half smile, and he says two words: Orson Welles. And is there any validity to that? I mean, that did cause some kind of a panic.
There was a panic, but it was understandable because the story wasn't just that something had happened, but that people in New Jersey. I was in New Jersey at the time. I didn't hear about the story. It was in 1938. I was 4 years old, but. People in New Jersey were told that we were being attacked by aliens and people being killed and so forth. So they were fearful of panic. It was probably overdone, but fear of panic is a common concern.
It may not have been 5 million people who panicked, but it's hard to tell.
That's right.
Wells said that the studio was filled with cops halfway through the broadcast, so something was going on.
Well, yeah. People were scared. Yeah. Let's face it, the war in Europe was just about to begin.
Right.
And so that was real. And Hitler was real. And, you know, the United States forgets. We thought the war started in December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor Day, right? I remember that.
Yeah.
No, it started a couple of years earlier in Europe when Germany attacked England. Poland first, and then they were bombing England.
Yeah.
We were Johnny-come-latelys, hoping we'd stay out. Political discussion. Let's stay out of the war. Leave it to those guys.
So they had a legitimate fear, perhaps, that people would not have been able to handle the truth. Of course, that doesn't apply now. I don't think people would go rushing out into the streets now with a similar...
I don't think so. Oh, if you could handle the atomic bomb. I mean, can you imagine the reaction? I remember when they said that, you know, and the war will be over. Well, it was within just a few days after the first atomic bomb. But tens of thousands of people being killed by one bomb.
Yeah.
So if in the cosmic Watergate kind of vein, when I read your most recent book, I was a little confused, Stanton, if you were advocating that the government should reveal everything they know, or if in fact you were arguing sort of in the same vein as the Manhattan Project, that in fact some secrets are meant to be kept and should still be kept. So I'm not quite clear on your stance on that.
Well, okay. I personally... do think some secrets need to be kept. I would like us to be told that indeed aliens are out there when we're ready to handle what that means. What does that do to religion? Do we need to worry about them? Do we need to defend ourselves against them? And the technology. I don't see why the United States should put what it has learned from evaluation, examination of wreckage more than one time. Put that out on the table if the Russians and Chinese aren't putting out what they have learned. Because, let's face it, the most important implication of this is the development of a weapon that can allow you to control the world. If we could duplicate flying saucer behavior, you know, up, over, down, right angle turns, et cetera, silently, you rule the planet. Nobody could hold a candle to us.
That could cause a war in itself if the others.
Well, that's right. You know, people are funny. Take action in advance to make sure it doesn't get worse.
So is
preemptive strike. How's that?
Mm-hmm. So is the U.S. government then justified in their attitude of creating a cosmic Watergate and denying an obfuscation and weather balloons and all kinds of crazy
stuff?
Well,
I'm not justifying that. I'm saying they can, and there's a certain amount of sense to it. The world's a dangerous place, and do we know what the aliens want? Somebody the other day told me the reason for the real secrecy is we have found mutilated bodies, mutilated by aliens. I'm not saying that's true. I'm just saying there's a story that's one of the reasons we're keeping the secret, because these aren't good guys.
But, you know, if they did want to, you know, supposedly take over the joint, if you want to use an expression, it would be more logical if that were their motive to have done it by now, you know,
sure.
Assuming they are here in any force, then wait for us to get stronger and stronger and stronger.
Yeah,
so
I agree with you.
Doesn't that take it off the table then? The whole idea of War of the Worlds type scenario was probably,
you know,
not.
If we knew what was going on, it would be easy to answer that question. I don't know what's going on, and I don't pretend to. I mean, I know where the planet's being visited. Governments are covering up, but we don't know all that they're covering up. And we don't know why the aliens are here. There are many stories that indicate they're very interested in our nuclear weapons. You know, at Malmstrom Air Force Base, where 10 missiles went offline one after the other when a UFO showed up at the gate.
Mm-hmm.
That's scary. You know, it happened in Russia, too. So they're non-discriminatory. But it would appear that they're very concerned about our nuclear weapons, and I think any sensible person would be. It's not just that there are weapons, but we have shown a willingness to attack. In World War II, we nice guys here killed 50 million people.
Yeah.
We destroyed 1,700 cities. After the war, we exploded 2,000 nuclear warheads. That surprised a lot of people. It's more than that many, but we have. We Earthlings.
What would alien observers have thought of Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Right. Well, that's what I mean.
Puny.
You know, the proof is there.
We're not nice.
No, we're not. And so...
Speak for yourself, Ed.
Maybe they're here to quarantine us, you know.
Mark just said he was nice, but the rest of us are.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Friedman, in the summer of 1947, was there an unusual amount of UFO sightings?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, Kenneth Arnold's got a lot of attention. That was June 24th, 47. There had been sightings before that, but not much. But Arnold was a very reputable individual. He had a few thousand hours as a pilot. He spotted 9 objects. He followed them, observed them for many minutes. They had extraordinary capability, maneuverability, and he timed their flight. He knew they were going over 1,200 miles an hour. That was scary as could be. And in the next couple of weeks, there were hundreds of sightings.
I wonder what was so special about the summer of 1947 that there was suddenly a profusion of sightings and crashes.
Well, maybe they just arrived at that point.
Maybe the word had gone out before that. Hey, send reinforcements. We got idiots to watch here. I don't know. Motivation of alien. Maybe they were heading this way from someplace else. Let's stop by that other planet. Ooh, boy.
Bob's favorite movie in this vein is the original, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and Cloud 2 and his famous speech. And when I read your book, I was struck by the fact that you kind of make that argument, the same argument that is expressed in that film, that we need to evolve and become better galactic citizens before any alien society or association would ever have anything to do with us. Is that a fair statement?
Doesn't it make sense? They realized how much damage we could do. I mean, you know, one H-bomb that the Soviets released, releasing the energy of 57 million tons of TNT. You know, think about that for a minute. These aren't nice guys here.
Yeah, they can be perhaps forgiven for not wanting us in their neighborhood. That's probably a fair statement.
Yeah, I agree.
Your first radio interview, I understand it was 1967 UFOs. So here we are 50 years later. I'm sure that we rank in the very bottom of your radio interviews, but
we're doing our best.
But I wanted to ask you a question, and I wonder if people have ever thought to ask this before, but have you personally ever seen a UFO?
Oh, I get asked that quite often because some people presume that's the reason I believe in flying saucers. I saw one. No, I've never seen a flying saucer or an alien. point out, however, that I spent 14 years chasing neutrons and gamma rays as a nuclear physicist for little companies like GE, GM, Westinghouse, Aerojet General, McDonnell Douglas. I worked on more canceled programs than anybody. You know. But no, I've never seen one, as I've never seen a neutron or a gamma ray. You don't need to see something to believe it.
No, I wasn't suggesting that. I was just as a personal element, if you'd had or not. You mentioned two in passing, and I want to circle back to this, about the Roswell crash, that, and you used the plural, the crashes or other crashes.
Oh, yes.
What other crashes might there be that you think are noteworthy that we should maybe turn our attention to for a future episode?
Well, one is the Plains of San Augustine, which is out where the Very Large Array Radio Telescope is, out in the middle of nowhere. In New Mexico. Another was in Aztec, New Mexico, which we used to laugh at, but Scott and Suzanne Ramsey in their book, The Aztec Incident, have done an enormous amount of work collecting information about what happened in Aztec. That's up in the Four Corners area where the four states come together, you know? And that was a big one, about over 90 feet in diameter, and there were bodies on board and so forth. And they really did a bang-up job. There's Kecksburg in Pennsylvania, 16 seconds it was, and there was another one. Suddenly I lost track.
Sorry, did you say something in Pennsylvania? What year?
Kecksburg in the early 60s.
Kecksburg.
Are these all sites that have been that were sanitized by the military after?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so
you can understand that. What are you going to do? Leave pieces of an alien spacecraft around for anybody to come by? Hey, can I have a piece? I just want a souvenir.
How would you rank Shag Harbor, Nova Scotia?
Oh, Shag Harbor is another one too. I'm sorry. I think that was a very good case.
Canadian Roswell, some call it.
Well, yeah, of course. And in a sense, it's better in some ways because there were witnesses to the thing going into the water. Nobody saw the Roswell thing come down. They found wreckage later. But the RCMP was on that site because there were people driving by who saw it and called and thought it was an airplane that had crashed. You know, people want to be helpful. There's a TWA crash down in Maritime Canada. And
Swiss Air, right?
Yeah.
So, Shag Harbor, I've been down there, and I've talked to some witnesses. Remember, it was 20 years after Roswell, so people are younger by quite a lot.
Right, yeah.
And still around. And there was one down in Brazil that I'm aware of. There are probably a bunch of others, but you can understand governments wanting to cover it up.
Would every government be monolithic that way? Every government would have the same sort of attitude and stance as, say, the U.S. government or the Russians or the Chinese?
Well, I think so. Because remember, one thing that UFOs represent, if we got aliens visiting here, there isn't anybody who speaks for the planet. We got, 198 countries? I don't know what the latest number is, something like that. There's no earthling government. And so people in power, I hate to say this, but people in power want to stay in power. Is that a fair rule for the world opera?
I've never been in power, so I don't know how they feel about it.
That's why Klaatu didn't want to speak to just the president of the United States. He wanted to speak to a larger group.
Film does a good job making that point too. It's not just U.S. centric. It's like I want to talk to everybody, and I'm not going to add my contribution to your petty squabbles. That was another great line.
Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? When you stand back and look at it.
Yeah. Although in the movie, that alien was a lot more hands-on, shall we say, than these.
Nicely put.
Yeah.
Well, remember, there's something else going on today, too. This year, the military budget on planet Earth is a cool $1 trillion. U.S. about half of that. Now, how many kids died of starvation yesterday and the day before and the day before that?
Yeah.
In other words, how do we look to them? A primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare.
Yeah.
You know, that sounds terrible, but it's true, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's, it's been said if we had spent even a fraction of the money on weaponry, on cancer research, we probably would have had a cure by now.
And on feeding poor people, starving people.
And, yes. Yeah. We give the impression we just don't care. So, and we'd rather beat each other over the head with nuclear clubs.
Robert, I know you're just dying to ask more questions. You got a whole bunch lined up. So.
No, I just wanted to ask Mr. Friedman if he finds Fredericton Airport adequate and sufficient to do all of his world travels and international.
Well, I wish there were flights from here to the United States.
Okay.
Because I have to go from here to Montreal or Toronto or Ottawa or Halifax. There was, for a 2-year period, there were flights from here to Boston on Delta, and that was great.
That's right. And in Moncton, too, I think there were flights to the United States. Yeah.
And from Halifax, there are. But Fredericton, for people who are listening, a town of about 50,000 people, great place to raise a family. Home of the University of New Brunswick. My daughter, two miles from the house. Daughter went to college there, graduated.
Excellent.
So, in terms of raising a family, look, we moved here from California, outside San Francisco. And California has a lot of attractions. I've never regretted the move.
New Brunswickers like to hear things like that. If you were from the San Francisco area, you should have moved to St. John, because we have maybe even more fog than San Francisco. But did your daughter study science too?
No.
No?
She majored in psychology.
Psychology, okay.
Does anyone in your family have the same interest in UFOs that you do? Or?
My late sons were interested. They came with me to lectures. My youngest one sold books at my lecture and stuff. He was very interested. Not in a crusading sort of way.
Mr. Freeman, do you think we'll ever see the day that, as you say, one country can't speak for everybody, but that some kind of announcement will be made that, okay, folks, they've been here. There is life out there. It has been visiting. We don't see any immediate threat, but we just want you to know. Or is this basically...
I'm hoping that at some point, there's an old saying, new ideas come to be accepted, not because their opponents come to believe in them, but because their opponents die and a new generation grows up that's accustomed to them.
Yeah.
So that may be the case here. And, it's like when segregation was being gotten rid of slowly in the States. In the States where they did it one grade at a time in school, it went over much better than trying to make everybody change, at once. You get accustomed.
Well, we've been kind of inoculated by, we've had Star Wars and Star Trek and 2001 and Close Encounters.
I don't think people are terribly frightened about aliens. Do you? I don't think any.
I don't think they're going to. It's not 1938 anymore.
Yeah, there are no riots in the street.
I think the idea that there is other life in the universe is totally accepted. I think a very small proportion would reject that notion. And
there are some religious people who do. I've been lectured by people who say the Bible doesn't say there are aliens out there. Well, I recommend that they read the book The Bible and Flying Saucers by Dr. Barry Downing, who's got a bachelor's in physics and a doctor of divinity. Mm-hmm. Divine physics, says Pete. Great guy.
Well, you know, I'm amazed by your stamina and vitality. You are 82 years old.
Yeah, I got 3 weeks. Well, on the 29th, I will be 83.
So that's amazing, and we hope that you run forever, Stanton. But in younger generations of UFO researchers, is there anyone in particular that you see as your successor or someone that you really admire for their work and effort?
The one young man that I really appreciate is John Greenwald. He's only in his 30s, and he's got the Black Vault website. And he's got over 1 million pages of UFO-related material on there. And he's been working at it since he was 16, I think, when I had my first contact with him.
Is that Greenwald?
G-R-E-E-N-E-W-A-L-D.
Okay.
The Black Vault is another way to look him up.
Okay.
He's a great guy, and he makes loads of Freedom of Information Act requests, and he knows how to get stuff from the government. Not always easy. But
Well, it's interesting when they do release a document, and then they blacked out so much of it, it's just like a couple of periods and a comma left that you could actually see.
Well, yeah, I get people to laugh at my lectures when I show the NSA documents. They released 156 pages of top secret Umbra NSA UFO documents. Yeah. The only problem is you can read one sentence per page.
Yeah. What if they realize, though, the fact that they blacked out so much of it might cause people to say, well, what are you hiding if you have to black it out?
Well, some of us have said that. The NSA wipes out.
Okay.
The CIA blacks. And it's interesting that the NSA says, we can't find those documents. People want a set of these whited out documents. They can't find the original.
Yeah, well, I imagine if they looked hard enough, they could find it.
Well, that's conceivable, yeah.
Yeah.
Stanton, you've written widely on this subject, and you've published quite a long list of books. Are there some you would like to take the opportunity to mention? I mean, you've sold all your books on the Roswell 70th anniversary, but I'm sure people...
Well, sure. There are still books around. I didn't mean I sold all there are, but the ones I had with me. Yeah. Kathleen Martin and I have done 3, and they're still selling well. Our latest book is Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers.
A takedown of the nasty, noisy negativists, your arch enemies through the years.
Well, what can I say? the easiest thing to do is to go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and it lists all the books, and you can order books. And one thing you get from me that you can't get from Amazon, and they sell a lot of my books, is an autograph.
Great. That's cool.
I autograph all the books I send out. That's I know good people to know. Want them. And so
I might take you up on one of those.
Yeah, well, the website has other things on it besides the books, but it is a chance to, and I also list the upcoming talks and stuff like that. So.
Okay. Right. Well, we sure appreciate having you on, Stanton. You're at the top of our dream wish list, and when you actually responded and said you would be on our show, we were over the moon.
Yeah, this has been great. Thank you so much.
This has been a
My
great
pleasure,
honor.
Guys.
Great honor.
All right.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
Have a
much.
Good one.
Thank you.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
Wow, guys. That's amazing.
Oh, my God. We had him already. I mean.
Yeah, it's downhill from here.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah. Well, on that upbeat note, let's end the program with a little bit of music. Robert, this is in honor of your favorite movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and the character Klaatu. Clearly, Stanton Friedman shares the sentiment of that movie that maybe human beings are just a little too violent, making extraterrestrial people a little nervous about allowing us into their club. This is a song from a Canadian group called Klaatu. Yeah. And a song about UFOs called Calling Occupants of Interplanetary Craft. So on behalf of Edward O'Reilly, Robert Selby, and myself, Mark O'Connor, watch out for the probe. This is Klaatu.
In your mind, you have capacities, you know, to telepath.
with messages through the vast unknown. Please close your eyes and concentrate with every thought you think. Upon the recitation we're about to sing. Close your eyes, you concentrate. Together, that's right.